From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Southern California cities are trying to respond to resident complaints about coyotes and demands that the animals be trapped and removed. There's a perception the number of coyotes and their aggressiveness have increased this year. But coyote experts say trapping can make the problem of aggressive coyotes worse. We'll explore the challenge right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Have you ever taken a brief moment to look something up online only to find yourself clicking link after link after link? That's a near daily experience for me. My obsessive tendencies take root in Wikipedia and other internet troves of information. Later this morning, I'll share one of my latest odd treks down the internet rabbit hole. And we'll hear from listeners who share my tendencies. How do you, if you're like me, how do you manage that impulse? And what are some of the oddest starts where you started looking something up and ended up somewhere totally different as you followed link after link after link? We'll talk about that later on Air Talk this morning. But first, another summer of public outcry over coyotes across Southern California. Residents are demanding that their cities do something about what's perceived to be greater numbers and greater aggressiveness of coyotes. One of the most recent and terrible cases, a Buena Park man who came home Friday night to find blood everywhere in his house as a coyote or coyotes apparently entered the dog door, came in, attacked, and killed his smaller dog, seriously injured his larger dog. Fortunately, that dog will survive. That an instance, at least I've never heard, about a coyote actually coming into the house through a dog door like that. But we have plenty of terrible accounts of dogs and cats being attacked and killed or seriously injured by coyotes. The question is what to do about it. And joining us to talk about what we know and as well as holes in our knowledge when it comes to coyotes is Neve Quinn, who's Human Wildlife Interactions Advisor with University of California's Cooperative Extension. Thank you very much, Neve, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hey, Larry, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. First of all, the idea that we have a particularly robust population of coyotes this year and that perhaps the heavy rains of the winter contributed to larger packs, is that true or not?
So it's hard to know. Nobody's really counting coyote numbers in California. And we know we have lots of coyotes in Southern California, but it's hard to put a kind of a pin in exactly how many numbers. Now, trying to judge if there's more this year than last year is very, very difficult, of course, because if no one was counting last year and no one is counting this year, well, then we don't know.
So it's just anecdotes. And that's one of the challenges in social media, of course, magnifies the whole scale of the problem, because now we're able to communicate with each other about what we see in our neighborhoods. But let's talk a bit about coyote behavior. When we see coyotes in our neighborhood, you know, what sorts of distances do we believe they travel? How territorial are they and confined within given areas? What do we know about coyotes and how they move?
So we know that there's kind of two different types of coyotes. There's generally coyotes that exist in packs. So that's coyotes that have family groups that are territorial. So these areas are defended by these coyotes. And then we have another type of coyote, a transient coyote, which is a solo coyote that roams much, much further than your packs. And they're kind of either looking for a territory, they're looking for a mate, they're looking to, you know, maybe create their own pack or maybe trying to get in with another pack. And they can be sometimes loosely related to a nearby pack, or they may have traveled, you know, several kilometers or miles away from where they originated from, looking for food, space, territory, the things that they need to survive.
Patterns are interesting. I have a coyote who over the past couple of weeks, every night, same time, comes right by my front window, right by my front door, and then down the steps and down the street. And it's like clockwork. And I didn't realize they were so predictable in some cases.
Well, it probably depends on their prey. So you might find that, you know, that's the time that maybe the neighborhood cats are returning home because people are, you know, being more careful about trying to keep their cats in. Or that might be the time where local rabbit populations or gophers or other things that they eat become more active, or it's a better time for them to hunt. And even though they're pack animals, Larry, they don't actually generally hunt in packs. So generally, because their food is so small, you can imagine like trying to share a gopher, even between two people. It's not a very big meal. So it's kind of the same with coyotes. They don't tend to share their food.
Yeah, I wouldn't share my gopher with anybody.
Yeah.
That's for sure. That's not enough. Yeah. I want my own gopher. Well, let me open up the phones for listeners to call in with questions. We're very fortunate to have an expert on coyotes, but even she'd be the first to admit there's a lot we don't know about coyotes and their efforts to try and research and better understand them. Neve Quinn with us from UC Cooperative Extension, Human Wildlife Interactions Advisor. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Neve, we've had some people getting up at city council meetings, you know, talking about attacks on their pets, you know, very, very difficult, traumatic events for pet owners, and demanding that the cities go out, capture and relocate or put down the coyotes that they trap. What's the downside of trapping and either releasing elsewhere or killing the coyotes?
Well, in the state of California, it's illegal to translocate wildlife without a permit. So that even means that if you catch a squirrel in your backyard, you're not supposed to take it away and release it anywhere. And that's true for coyotes as well. So it is a possibility that the California Department of Fish and Wildlife would grant permits for relocation of certain wildlife. And we see it certainly for bears and for mountain lions, but we never see it for coyotes. And I think the reason we never see it for coyotes is coyotes are territorial. There's a lot of them everywhere. They're not an endangered species. And so it doesn't make sense to take one and put it somewhere else where either it would still eat cats and dogs, or it would potentially just succumb to pressure from the pack that's already there. And then, you know, the other things you hear at city council meetings are, you know, there's a lot of cities that are relying on hazing. I don't know if you know what hazing is.
Yeah, where you try and scare it off.
Exactly. So you try and make yourself big and wave your arms about. And the idea is that you kind of make the coyote scared of people, like this kind of aversive conditioning type thing. And we don't know if it works or not. There's no scientific evidence to show that hazing works for coyotes. And so cities are relying probably a little bit too heavy on this type of kind of management action because we don't know if it works. And so right now what we're trying to do is we actually have some GPS collars that we're trying to put on coyotes. We're going out, we're trying to trap coyotes and collar them in cities across Los Angeles County in cooperation, you know, with UC, with the County of Los Angeles, and with Western University, who is where our veterinarians are situated, and trying to collar the coyotes and to try and haze them and see, do they change the space that they use? Do they change their behavior? Do they make sure that they're active more at night than during the day? Or does the amount of attacks on pets decrease during this kind of hazing regime that we've planned?
All right. And interesting that we don't know. It's just sort of assumed that that works. Once again, we're talking with Human Wildlife Interactions Advisor with University of California's Cooperative Extension, Neve Quinn. We're taking your calls with your questions about how best to deal with coyotes, the potential threat to animals. There have even been examples of coyotes coming up and biting kids or biting adults. Was a couple years ago we had like 15 bites in the state, I think, Neve.
Yeah, it's not. It's. I mean, it's in Southern California, Larry. There's probably more bites in Southern California on people than there are in the entire country combined.
Wow. And do we, I mean, obviously we've got density, but so does the Bay Area. Why do we think Southern California has so many more?
I think it's a combination of a couple of things. I think we have a very dense people population. I think we have a very dense coyote population. And I think that we have some behaviors in California or in Southern California that we're not really seeing in other places. Like, you know, we know that coyotes in Southern California eat way more cats than the kind of whatever is shown to be eaten in other states. Like, you know, there could even be like, you know, 20% more cats consumed in Southern California than there is in other states.
Wow.
And we know we have things like, you know, like you already mentioned, like coyotes going into doggy doors. We have the, I don't know if you've ever heard of the wall walkers, the coyotes that walk along the walls in the housing developments and look into the yards. We don't really see that in a whole lot of other places. So it could be that the coyote behavior in Southern California is slightly different, but we won't know that for sure unless we study them properly.
Now, you've been part of research that's looked at the stomach contents of coyotes, right, to determine what percentages of different types of food. And so you mentioned about cats, for example. So what appears to be the mix of their diet?
So they do eat a lot of cats, and they also eat a lot of cottontail rabbits, and they eat some gophers, some rats. And then you wouldn't believe, Larry, what we found in those stomachs. This study was done in cooperation with California State University at Fullerton. And I had a wonderful student there who dissected these disgusting bags of goo, basically, very enthusiastically, very excitedly opened them to see what was inside them. And what's great about a stomach content analysis is that we know absolutely that that contents came from a coyote, whereas if you do a scat study, like a study on the poop of the coyote, it's pretty hard to tell, actually, if that poop came from a coyote. It could have come from a number of different animals. So we know for sure it came from coyotes. We collected over 300 coyotes. We examined their stomach contents, and we found baseball gloves, shoes, holstered furniture. Coyotes literally eat everything.
Although, as I recall reading about your work, it was a little surprising, at least to me, that it didn't appear roof rats were much of the diet. Because one of the things we hear about the positives of coyotes is that they go after vermin. But it didn't sound like, from what you found, that was the case.
So it's kind of a complicated issue, but anyone that's done Biology 101 will have heard of something called an R-selected species. And they're species that reproduce really, really, really quickly at really, really high rates. So they make lots of babies lots of times during the year. That's what an R-selected species is, and that's things like rats. And predators have an inability to control R-selected species. So it's a biological impossibility that any predator, bird of prey, coyote, mountain lion, chupacabra, you name it, can control any of these R-selected species.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And what percentage of the coyote stomach contents were cats again?
Well, we're still trying to correlate and collate our results. And so for us, we're doing a hard part analysis and a DNA analysis. And so it's over 14% so far with our hard part analysis, but it looks like with confirmation from DNA analysis that that is increasing.
I would never guess that cats are such a big part. I mean, obviously we hear about attacks on cats all the time, but still coyotes need to eat a lot, to survive. I'm very surprised it's that big a part of their diet.
Yeah, I mean, cats are kind of, I guess, easy prey, and it's just so unfortunate. We have a tool called Coyote Cacher where people can report their encounters to this tool. And, you know, when I checked through, what has happened, it's just heart-wrenching to read the stories of people that have come home to either find bits of cats or can't find their cat or blood in areas. And it's terrible.
Well, it's traumatic. I mean, have a member of the family killed like that to come home and find it. It's horrible.
I think of my own pets and I would just be devastated. It's just so terrible. But the only way that we're going to be able to keep our pets safe is that if we keep them attended and apparently now locked in the house, because even houses with doggy doors don't appear safe anymore.
Yeah, I know that's it's certainly changing my behavior. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And just to clarify, on the roof rats, I mean, is the speed of the rats, is it hard for the coyotes to catch them?
It could be. You know, roof rats are called roof rats because they spend a lot of the time off the ground. And so that could be why they don't have a lot of them in the diet. So they can escape up trees. They're very good climbers. You know, they can climb vertical surfaces. So, you know, bricks, stucco, things like that, they can cling on to anything that they can cling on to, they can climb up. And so that might be why. And, you know, cats might just be, I mean, we all know cats are kind of interesting animals. You know, they kind of stand their ground a little bit almost. And that could be why. It could be related to their behavior as well, that more cats are actually eaten than rats. And a cat is a pretty big reward for a coyote. I mean, that's a decent meal.
We'll continue our conversation with UC Cooperative Extension's Neve Quinn. She's Human Wildlife Interactions Advisor. Again, I'd love to hear your questions for her about coyotes. So much we don't know, and the question how to live with coyotes, they're not going anywhere. That's clear, how to deal with it. One of the big problems is there are people who think it's a good idea to feed coyotes. That's kind of mind-boggling, I know, but there are people who think that they need to help the coyotes survive by feeding them. So we'll talk about what can cities do to try and control coyote populations, also to keep the pet populations in their cities safe. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're talking about coyotes in Southern California, how to deal with them. Neve Quinn of UC Cooperative Extension, Human Wildlife Interactions Advisor, joining us to talk about coyote behavior and what we can do. Neve, to your knowledge, are some cities looking at actually enforcing laws that some of them have on the books against feeding wild animals?
Yes, I know for sure some cities do, and some cities write tickets, and it's exactly what they should do. We know very little surrounding the bite incidents in Southern California, but what we do know for some of them is that they are related to intentional feeding. But it's hard to really divide intentional feeding from unintentional feeding, because we all have, you know, we live in Southern California for several reasons, but, you know, we have the most incredible weather here and we're able to provide our own food in our own backyards. I mean, how many people in Southern California have a backyard where they don't grow any food? And so that food is very accessible for coyotes, but it is important that we don't intentionally feed coyotes for sure. And I think it's important that it's enforced as well. I think that if we don't have rules that are enforced, people won't follow them.
Let's see. Ian in Anaheim says, I think the main problem is coyotes have lost their fear of humans. Wouldn't it make sense for private citizens to kill the coyotes if they're threatening their pets or family instead of calling animal services? Well, the question would be how you do it, because so let's say you trapped a coyote and they're pretty smart to avoid traps, right, Neve? Then what would you do with it?
So coyotes are non-game mammals, so within legal means you can lethally control coyotes, but there's certain rules that you have to follow. And one of the big things in urban areas is that in most urban areas, you can't discharge a firearm, and that also includes an air rifle. And I'm not suggesting that you would ever use an air rifle to euthanize a coyote, but or even a low-caliber air rifle. But it's the problem is that people want to kill coyotes for killing pets. And if you kill one or two coyotes, that just means that there's going to be five or six more coyotes waiting in the wings to still eat the pets. We don't know for sure, because there's also no real data on the effects of lethal control on reducing the numbers of conflicts. But you, in a city, it doesn't make sense that we would be arming our citizens to be wildlife managers. And you're totally right, Larry. It is not easy to catch coyotes. We were out for 5 days last week and we caught none. And we're working with a professional trapper.
Yeah, they're smart, and they learn, of course. So Ian's point, though, is that is there a way to make coyotes more fearful of humans? And you said the hazing, that's not backed by evidence that making yourself big, yelling, making noise, that has a lasting effect. Anything else you'd suggest?
Well, we don't know hazing doesn't work either. So we don't know it does work. We don't know it doesn't work. It's hard to know because nobody has ever tested it. So it may be through our study that we come up with ways to make coyotes change their behavior, but we don't know. There may be kind of higher levels of hazing that might work better. So, for example, probably some of your listeners are familiar, Larry, with the issue with bears in some of our kind of more foothill communities, or in and around, you know, in Tahoe, the bear issue is particularly bad there. And they're using kind of higher levels of hazing, which is kind of like, I guess you could call it like a memorable pain, a kind of a kick in the backside, so to speak, as opposed to trying to ruin the coyote's self-esteem by shouting at it. They use beanbags, kind of these beanbag guns, you know, kind of more. They use dogs as well to really scare the bears up trees. And it's thought that might be this kind of higher level of hazing, but that's very expensive. It requires trained biologists to use these hazing techniques. And obviously discharging any kind of a projectile in an urban environment is difficult.
All right. Shimeon in Valley Glen, good to have you with us.
Hi there. We've had an uptick in coyotes in our street, and we're about 3 blocks from Valley College, which I've been hearing from various people that seems to be a breeding ground, or at least a den for us, a group of coyotes. We recently had 3 down our street the other day, and they got 3 chickens, a cat, and a crow. And a group of us got together and chased them away just by shouting. My question is, with the growth of the population, is there any way to feed them birth control substances in baited food to lessen the population?
Yeah, that's interesting. Is there any way of controlling them that way, Neve?
So I get this question all the time, Larry, and it's a very interesting question. It's a very interesting kind of perspective to have. Now, we don't have any specific birth controls for coyotes, but if you think about it, if you gave a coyote birth control and stopped it breeding, that doesn't stop it eating your pets.
But wouldn't it control the population in the longer run?
So a population can only sustain, or an area can only sustain a certain density. And so realistically, what it would do is it would level out the population, which is what nature would probably do anyway. And so we have lots of inward migration. So what we would get eventually would be that, you know, the pack numbers would start to dwindle, but they would just be replaced from immigrants basically coming in from the outside.
So you're saying that in areas that see many more coyotes, that there's going to be a natural ceiling. It's not like they're going to, you know, just keep growing and growing in numbers. There's a finite density the coyotes can reach.
Yeah, because they can only eat so much food. Now, I couldn't tell you, Larry, if those neighborhoods are already at saturation or if they're still growing. That is really difficult to know and a question that I can't answer.
All right. Simeon, I appreciate your call. Sylvia tweets at AirTalk, I have a great microchip pet door. It keeps non-approved pets out. That's interesting. I didn't realize there were those kinds of smart pet doors that are chip, requires that the chip communicates with the door to allow the authorized pet. Now, of course, if your pet's outside and can't get inside, that doesn't necessarily help, but at least it would help avoid a coyote coming in through the dog door into the house. Let's see. James in Silver Lake just has a behavioral question. Why do coyotes howl? And you often hear the pack of coyotes howling at night. What are they doing, Neve?
I think that's basically their chit-chat time, Larry. You know, they're very social animals, but as we discussed earlier, they don't generally hunt in packs, but they do get together afterwards in their packs, and that's potentially, you know, just them communicating with other pack members or potentially communicating with associates that are on the, you know, on the edges, or even as maybe a kind of a territory thing for packs that adjoin their territory.
Michael in Boston asks, I've never heard this question before, interbreeding with dogs. So this would be a good chance to talk about the species differences here.
Yeah, so there's no evidence that they are breeding with dogs, but they can be confused with dogs a lot. And so usually, you know, when, and coyotes are quick. Sometimes people just see them out of the corner of their eye and they're not really sure, did they see a dog or did they see a coyote? First off, here in the United States, almost all cities, especially in California, have leash laws. Okay, so it's very unusual to actually see a free-roaming dog nowadays, especially one the size of a coyote, but it does happen. And so what I say to people is, one of the easiest things for me anyway is a couple of really good indicators. Like, coyotes don't generally travel with their tails up, and dogs almost always do. Okay, so dogs...
All right.
Kind of always have their, don't really have their tails down and in between their legs, but coyotes do. And the other thing is that coyotes always have upright ears and dogs don't always, although sometimes they do. And then the other thing is the shape of the body itself. So in almost all dog breeds, their chest comes down as far as their elbows. Whereas with coyotes, they're kind of very leggy. They just look like they're all legs. And so their chest is kind of much higher than their elbows, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me the difference in how well or poorly fed they can be. You see some coyotes that just look so hale and hearty, and others that look just like they're desperate for the next meal. And they can be in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, you know, the ones that you're seeing that kind of don't look the best, they could be transient coyotes, they could be juveniles that are just trying to figure out what's going on. You know, they've kind of been maybe pushed out of the pack and they're still trying to find their feet. You know, like an 18-year-old that's still eating, like, you know, ramen after they're thrown out of the house. Eventually they figure out, like, how to use the stove, kind of a thing. And it's the same with coyotes. They could just be just trying to figure it out, you know, and they mightn't be, you know, closely associated with the pack in that area. And so that could be what happens.
All right. Niamh, thank you so much for spending this time with us. We appreciate your answering questions and talking about what we know and what we're trying to learn about coyotes and how they interact with us in urban Southern California. Thanks so much.
No worries, Larry. Anytime.
Niamh Quinn, University of California Cooperative Extension. She's Human Wildlife Interactions Advisor. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. Coming up, we'll talk about some dramatic statistical changes in home buying, foreign investment, huge change. Also, significant changes in African American homeownership rates. We'll talk about that after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Still a chance for you to reserve your space tomorrow's live broadcast of Air Talk from our Crawford Family Forum here at KPCC. Our 10 o'clock hour, a special hour devoted to the 50th anniversary of the landing on the moon and the first moonwalk. We have a great panel that we put together for the program tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. We'd love to have you in attendance. You can RSVP, it's free, of course, at kpecc.org/in-person. That's our 10 o'clock hour tomorrow, special hour devoted to the 50th anniversary of the first moonwalk. Also, you can, if you're not able to be here, you can live stream it at kpecc.org. We invite you to watch the program, not just listen to it if you can't be here. Again, you can reserve your space, kpecc.org/in-person. Well, we got some significant news on the homeownership front, including a dramatic drop in foreign investment in real estate here in the U.S. Joining us from the Wall Street Journal, reporter covering housing and the economy, Laura Cusisto. Laura, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's start, first of all, with the dramatic drop in foreign investment here in real estate. How big a drop are we seeing?
It's quite remarkable. Over the last 2 years, we've seen foreign investment in U.S. real estate drop by about half, driven by a 56% drop in Chinese investment in real estate over the last year. And as you know, that drop in Chinese investment is particularly significant for Southern California because they were a big player in the high end of the housing market there.
Well, yes. And so do we know, is the drop in California, obviously it's has a bigger impact because the percentage of investment here, but do we know if the drop has been greater at all here, or is this spread across the country?
So the drop, I would say, is focused, it's concentrated in a few markets where we've seen a lot of Chinese investment. California is the biggest one. It was the biggest target for Chinese investors. And then we've also seen a drop in the high-end condo market in New York. And then we've also kind of seen a pullback in Miami, although that was driven more by South American investors.
And do we know where that money is going, if it's going in being invested in the U.S. elsewhere?
So I've heard anecdotally, this doesn't really show up very much in the data, but I've certainly heard anecdotally about this idea that it's going to less expensive markets. So, for example, Texas, even I hear about Chinese investors buying single-family rentals in places like Detroit. So there may be a little bit of that. There may be a little bit of a search for bargains. But I think that the bigger reality is it's just not going anywhere in the U.S. It's not getting out of China. China's gotten much stricter about letting people take money out of the country. And so I think that's a big part of it. And then I've heard, you know, the U.S. is no longer the flavor of the moment. People are looking at markets like Portugal that just sort of have allure as being a new place that, you know, all your friends haven't invested in.
Laura Cusisto joining us from The Wall Street Journal. Also with us, the director of the Lusk Center for Real Estate at USC, Richard Green. He's a housing policy expert. Richard, good to have you with us. I appreciate it. What is the impact, as you see it, on the Southern California housing market with this dramatic decline in Chinese investment?
Well, again, as noted, we are disproportionately affected by it. So nationally, the Chinese bought maybe 2% of all the houses in the United States. So from a national perspective, they don't matter all that much. But they, of course, were very much concentrated in Southern California, in particular parts of Southern California. So if you go to the San Gabriel Valley, for example, you will see there's been lots of Chinese buyers. And of course, very large projects in downtown Los Angeles have been financed by the Chinese. The Greenland Properties project down there and the Oceanwide project down there. And we're seeing one of them, I mean, stopped construction for a while. So it's actually very visible. And we're seeing increase in inventory in Southern California. We're seeing price increases softening a lot. We may even see a price decline this year. And I don't think that's only because of China, but it's certainly partially because of China.
Well, and the Chinese buyers are notable, or were notable, because often they paid all in cash, right?
Often they would, yes. And it at the peak, we had about 35% of transactions in Southern California were all cash transactions, and a good share of that was the Chinese buyers.
35% were all, I didn't never realize it reached that point. That's astounding.
Yep.
I mean, given the values of Southern California real estate?
Yes, that's correct. But it's, I mean, part of it was just more generically investors who were buying single-family houses to rent them out often use cash, because when the business was in its early stages, lenders don't want to be lending to that kind of new adventure. And so people would raise cash and buy that way.
Richard Green, USC, directs the Lusk Center for Real Estate. We're talking about the dramatic decline in foreign investment in real estate, particularly here in Southern California, dropping by half over the past 2 years. If you have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPCC. 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Laura, you've also written about how African-American homeownership across the U.S. has reached its lowest level, and what are the factors that appear to have led to the decline in Black homeownership?
Yeah, so this is definitely a very different side of this story. These are homeowners. We saw a big run-up in both Black and Hispanic homeownership during the last housing boom, and then a huge decline, a lot of people losing their homes. But what's sort of remarkable is that even that other groups are recovering, especially Hispanics, Blacks are not seeing that same kind of recovery. And that's really worrisome because the economy is about as good as it's going to get. It's certainly as good as it's been in a very long time. And it's very hard to figure out why Blacks aren't coming back into homeownership. And I think it has to do with a few factors. One is I think lenders not really paying attention to that group anymore. And I think sort of a legacy of housing discrimination that seems to really have sort of taken hold. And Blacks sort of who I talked to just said they feel a real sense of disillusionment with homeownership.
And I wonder if disproportionately they found themselves in those difficult loans that required balloon payments and variable rates that left them in, position where they lost their homes. And that's part of the, the shyness about going down that path again. Richard Green, same question for you. And I know generally homeownership is down in California. Just, the cost of buying is so high right now. But what do we see in racial disparities?
Well, I think exactly the point that you made is critical. Is we know that not only did African Americans disproportionately have subprime loans, toxic products, but many African Americans who were eligible for the highest quality mortgages were steered into these bad products. And so they could have been successful. They could have survived. And one of the things about the financial crisis that just stunned me was actually how few people defaulted on their mortgages. Lots of people, if they could make the payment, even if their house was worth a lot less than their mortgage, continued to do so. But that was if you had a good, fixed rate, understandable product. And I think lots of African Americans could have had that product but wound up not having it. But now we're also in a position where I think our underwriting has certain features that is tilted against African Americans in particular and people of color more generally. One in particular is if you're a contractor, so not on salary income, your income is discounted when you're underwritten for a loan. And we know African Americans and Latinos disproportionately have what I call 1099 jobs. Refer to the tax form you get at the end of the year instead of W-2 jobs. And so even though they may have the income necessary to buy a house, it doesn't fully count when the lender is underwriting them. And I think that has depressed the ability of African Americans to get back into the home market.
Also joining us is Ashley Thomas III, who's the National Third Vice President of the National Association of Real Estate Brokers. It's the nation's oldest Black real estate trade association, and he does business in South Los Angeles. Mr. Thomas, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What are you seeing about either reticence of African Americans to move into home ownership or barriers to being able to do so?
Well, thank you. But, this is definitely a multifaceted issue, and it needs to be addressed as such. I agree with all the comments that were brought up in terms of the features of loan products, bad products, and the recovery. But also it's important to note that income inequality still exists in 2019, and you couple that with a shortage of inventory, you have a segment of the population that cannot compete. The Washington Post also published an article last month speaking very specifically to student loans and its impact, having the greatest impact on African Americans. So this continues to grow at a pace that's now, at the center stage of American politics, and it definitely needs to be addressed in terms of how we calculate this. In terms of access, mortgages, and how that's calculated in underwriting. those are some barriers that are really impacting us currently.
You might well have heard of presidential candidate U.S. Senator Kamala Harris. She's proposed a $100 billion plan specifically aimed at closing the black homeownership gap. So this has even been injected into the presidential race as an issue.
Absolutely. And these are the types of programs that are definitely needed. In order to solve the problem, it has to be intentional to solve the problem. There's an old saying that says, a rising tide raises all ships, but that does not bring us forth to equality. That does not solve the issue. That just says, hey, when the upper 1% does better, then everyone should be doing better. And we don't find that that's always the case.
We'll continue our conversation with Ashley Thomas III of the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, the nation's oldest black real estate trade association. He does business as a broker in South Los Angeles. Richard Green of USC directs the Lusk Center for Real Estate. And Laura Cusisto of the Wall Street Journal has been writing about the dramatic decline in foreign investment in real estate, particularly in Southern California, as well as a fall off in black homeownership nationally. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're back in just 1 minute. We're looking at the latest trends in real estate, foreign investment, Latino, African American homeownership. We're at 866-893-KPECC. If you have questions of our guests, Laura Cusisto of the Wall Street Journal, who covers housing and the economy for the Journal with us, talk about the reporting she's just done, looking at the very issues we're talking about. In fact, that's what gave us the idea to do the segment. I was reading Laura's reporting on this, just found it fascinating. Richard Green, USC's Lusk Center for Real Estate, Ashley Thomas III of the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, who is a broker in South Los Angeles. So he's able to talk about both what's happening locally among African-American homeownership, but also how the national picture is looking as well. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Ashley Thomas III, I also wanted to ask you about gentrification in historically African-American communities. As you know very well, areas like Leimert Park, View Park, Baldwin Hills, Windsor Hills, many of the other traditionally black neighborhoods of Los Angeles have seen younger Caucasian home buyers who have come in because it's a more affordable place to buy a house in what are, you know, terrific communities. How has that, in your view, affected the inventory, particularly for African-American buyers?
Well, for one, we've never seen the inventory come back to marketplace. There's disposition of assets that were foreclosed upon in non-traditional manner. So in terms of inventory coming back to the market, it never really returned. There was use of auctions, and buyers want to get out and actually see the home. So this is very much has been a concern of ours. So when you have less inventory, the prices rise. And when the prices rise, and you have a competitive nature, and ultimately the ones that have the more income to come in or more assets to come in are going to win that bid. So I definitely see that change. But also we have to understand we are in Los Angeles. And so in Los Angeles, unless we figure out a way how to build homes in the ocean in the west, everyone's going to have to move eastward. And that's what we're experiencing. So we're trying to make sure that there are programs and policies surrounding making sure that people can work where they live and live where they work.
Are you seeing African-American homeowners in the area where you're a broker cash out at the peak of the real estate market and then move to the east, the Inland Empire, high desert, even out of state, cashing out from the value of their house?
I'm not seeing that trend as much. For the most part, people fear the drive. Traffic is a problem. And so you don't necessarily want to move an hour away, be late for work, and have different new challenges that exist. You want to be close to your children's school. I think every American wants to be live and work close to where their children go to school. So you don't really see that as much, but that's where people are being asked to go, is where they afford. And I think that that's a great question, because you have renters that can afford, based on rent control policies and different things like that, they can afford to live where they work now, and you're asking them to purchase a home and move an hour away. And so that becomes a greater challenge in terms of increasing home ownership.
From the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, National Third Vice President Ashley Thomas III with us. Let me go back to Richard Green of USC's Lusk Center for Real Estate. What are the trends we're seeing with Latino home buyers in Southern California?
So I was pleasantly surprised. I was running census numbers on them. And yes, the Latino, you saw a decline in Latino home ownership rate after the crash, as you did with everyone else. But there actually has been some recovery in that group here in Southern California. So among non-Hispanic whites, the home ownership rate is about 54%. And among Latinos, it's about 38-39%. Here in Southern California, and that's up a little bit from its low a few years ago. And so we have seen a small amount of recovery. Again, you don't want to get too excited about it. But what's striking is actually the gaps between white and Latino and white and black homeownership rate in LA County are much lower than they are nationally. But the bad news is that the homeownership rate is low for everybody.
Yeah, I was going to say it's because everybody's suffering, right?
Yeah, exactly. But in Southern California, there's about a 21 percentage point gap between whites and African Americans. And nationally, that number is more like 27%. So I don't know if you want to look at that as half full or half empty.
Mm-hmm. Historically, has Los Angeles, to your knowledge, Richard, had higher homeownership rates for African Americans? I was wondering, you know, after the Great Migration, with so many African Americans who came here, got union, you know, factory jobs and living wages and all, that boosted black homeownership here, didn't it?
It did, but in general, California has long had a very low homeownership rate by national standards. And so, again, if you look at the gap, it's been smaller. But if you look at the absolute number, it's also been smaller. And I think this is important with respect to gentrification, because if it weren't for the fact that African Americans were shut out of the housing market, the owner market, 30, 40, 50 years ago by rules from things like the FHA program, they would at least now be in a position that gentrification would make them richer and they would have options. But because they couldn't buy those houses 40, 50 years ago, they have not accumulated the wealth that would have otherwise resulted.
Richard Green, always a pleasure. Thank you for being with us and sharing your expertise on this.
It's always great to be with you, Larry.
Richard Green is director of USC's Lusk Center for Real Estate. He served in the Obama administration as a senior advisor, Department of Housing and Urban Development. Real quickly, back to Ashley Thomas III. What sorts of outreach are there to prospective African-American homebuyers to help them navigate the system and know what's available?
So currently at the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, we are engaged in our faith-based initiative where we're reaching out and getting our boots on the ground, working with local churches and trying to get back people that might have lost their home and now 10 years removed, they're able to get back into this, into the marketplace, and really teach on the importance of home ownership and establishing the legacy of building wealth. So we're doing everything that we can do. I think it's very important that we are also on a national level focused on policy. There's a great conversation going around about sustainability and making sure that those who are able to purchase a home can keep that home, and we 100% agree with that. However, we do not want policy to have an adverse effect to access. And so that's something that we can
right.
watch very closely, making sure that the door of accessing
right.
is not closed.
Thank you so much, Ashley Thomas, the Third National Association of Real Estate Brokers, nation's oldest black real estate trade association. My thanks as well to Wall Street Journal housing and the economy reporter Laura Cusisto. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I tend to be a little obsessive, and particularly when it comes to researching things. And with the internet, it's a very dangerous thing because I can look something up and then an hour and a half later, I'm still clicking on links. And I was thinking about that. I was relating in our morning editorial meeting, one of my latest forays down the rabbit hole with Wikipedia and the internet, and they were appropriately laughing at me and said, "Well, you know, we should talk about this because there are probably many listeners with their stories." That's exactly what we're going to do later this hour, is take your calls. If you share my obsession, and one factoid leads to another, and you end up down the trail of obscurity, share with us what's sort of your oddest, your funniest travels along that research route. And also, if you're someone who has, you know, become particularly enamored of this and lost track of time, how do you manage it? How do you contain that in your life? That's later this hour, right here on 89.3 KPCC. But first, earlier this week, in a presentation to the California Academy of Sciences, Tesla's and SpaceX's Elon Musk announced his game plan for hooking up brains to computers. He's got a team at Neuralink, which is one of his, you know, many endeavors that he's got going on, that enables there to be an interface between the brain and a computer. And to talk with us about how far that technology is advanced and what the biggest barriers are to taking it further is Elizabeth Lopato, deputy editor at the online news publication The Verge. She was at Tuesday night's presentation in San Francisco. Elizabeth, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Larry. It's very nice to be here.
So what did Musk say about what Neuralink has accomplished to this point?
Well, he said there were sort of two buckets of things that he said. The first bucket is the one that I'm going to deal with, and it's sort of the near-term material science, sort of things that are visible to us now. And so it is an interesting advance that does potentially move the field slightly forward. But the thing that was reassuring to me as someone who has been writing about brain-machine interfaces for the last 10 years is that it wasn't very far forward. This was pretty much in keeping with a lot of the things that we already know about how to hook a human brain up to a computer. So it seemed very, very feasible. And that's sort of the near-term stuff. The farther-term stuff about, you know, hooking your brain up to a computer in a healthy person and maybe, like, that's how we interact with AI, that seems much more far-fetched to me, but the nearer-term things actually seem pretty achievable.
Well, you write that Musk, in the Q&A portion, said a monkey has been able to control a computer with its brain?
That's right, yeah. So what he said was that they have been working with UC Davis, and that's where they're doing some of their, it sounds like, primate testing. And then he said, oh, yes, a monkey has been able to control a computer with his brain, and then one of the scientists standing next to him said, I didn't realize we were doing this today.
There goes Musk.
Never a dull moment.
Yeah, yeah. But it doesn't say what the monkey was able to control with the computer.
Well, so I have a fairly informed guess based on previous animal research, which may be incorrect. So I want to be clear that this is a guess, and I don't want to misinform anybody. But it turns out when you work with primates on these things, they really like juice. That's a really good reward. And so they'll do stuff for juice. And since if you wanted to train a monkey to use its brain to control a cursor on a computer, you would have a couple of areas where you would try to get the monkey to put the cursor. And then when the monkey put the cursor there, you'd reward it with juice. And then the monkey would do it again because the monkey likes juice.
Okay, so pretty basic reward seeking. There was the guy, what was it, back in the mid-aughts, who was able to play Pong with an interface?
That's right. So this is the first person with spinal cord paralysis to receive a brain implant. His name was Matthew Nagel. And so in 2006, he played Pong using only his mind, moved a cursor around on a screen, did a bunch of stuff. And obviously the technology has come a really long way since, you know, 2006. Like, we didn't even have iPhones then, right? So, you know, this is basically... What we're seeing here is years and years of basic research that was funded by academic institutions in the U.S. government starting to move into development in a commercial space, which is ideally the goal.
We're talking with The Verge's deputy editor, Elizabeth Lopato. She was at the Neuralink presentation presided over by Elon Musk Tuesday night at the California Academy of Sciences. Also with us is University of Pennsylvania professor of bioengineering and neuroscience, Conrad Cording. Professor, good to have you with us today.
Good afternoon.
What stood out to you in the Musk conversation of Tuesday night?
So what I loved about it is that in a way it puts all the good things together. So it's right that not one of the things that they do is like really out there, which is great because it convinces me that it may actually work. But what they do is they take all the best ideas and put it together. So you want thin wires because it's better for the brain and it tolerates it better. And so they have thin wires. You want a great way of getting it into brains, the wires. And they have a great idea about that. You need everything to be wireless, and they have that. It needs to be built to last, and they have that. So in a way, despite the fact that there's a lot of marginal improvements, by putting it all together, they're building just something that's truly magical, in my view.
You mentioned about the very thin wires to be able to send the impulses between the brain and the computer. When using primates right now, what do they use to do that, to carry the signal?
I think what's used most is this array of black rock. The way to think about it is like a little... It's an array of little needles. They're really short, like think a millimeter or something like that. And there's one of them, like five of them per millimeter, something like that. And so this is like a big block made out of silicon. And so by pushing that into the brain, in a way, that really disturbs the brain. And if you disturb the brain, that's not good, and it starts to degrade the quality of both your recording and it's potentially damaging the brain itself.
He also talked, if I'm not mistaken, I think I read this in Elizabeth's piece, about using lasers eventually to go through the skull instead of drilling through the skull to be able to put electrodes directly in the brain. How far are we from being able to do that?
Well, I haven't seen any evidence how good the lasers are. And I'm not sure how useful it even is. Now, like, ultimately, if you want to bring electrodes into the brain, you need to get to the brain. And if there's a skull in between, you need to drill. Now, you can drill with, like, a fancy laser drill, or you can drill with, like, an old-fashioned drill. But ultimately, that doesn't seem like it is the main problem from my perspective. I'm sure if these guys are thinking of making it be something that we implant into our brains to be thinking better, or having better memory or something. And once we're at that level, sure, it needs to be like LASIK. But at the moment, we're talking about helping patients that really need this. And at that level, the surgery isn't so much of a worry to me.
And patients who really need it, share with us the group of patients you think are would be the soonest to benefit from breakthroughs in this technology.
I think amputees are a great target, and people with spinal cord injury. So what we have there, these people perfectly well know what they would want their body to do, only in the case of the amputee, the body is missing. And in the case of the person with spinal cord injury, well, the connection to the body is missing. So the magical promise of this technology is if we could read what they want to do, if we could somehow get the data out of the brain that tells us what they want to achieve, we could basically use robotic technology to make that happen. So the person with spinal cord injury could control an arm again. The amputee could control their limbs again. So if we could make that work for them, that would just be incredible. And in fact, you can see how incredible it is. I'm sure you've seen Star Wars, haven't you?
Yes, of course.
In Star Wars, there's this great scene where Luke Skywalker loses the arm. It's chopped off. And then afterwards, his arm is just like yours or mine. Why? Because the prosthetic device in Star Wars is just as good as the real thing. And in a way, this is like the research that moves us into that direction.
We're talking with Conrad Cording of Penn, professor of bioengineering and neuroscience, and Elizabeth Lopato, deputy editor of The Verge, who's been writing about the Neuralink company created by Elon Musk. You have questions for our guests? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Rob writes on the page, who knew Elon Musk was the father of the Borg, making a Star Trek reference there. I mean, Elizabeth Lopato, obviously there are great concerns here. Anytime you're talking about connecting up a machine to a human, there are concerns about what that could bode, many, many, many years into the future. Did Elon Musk address that?
I mean, a little. One of the questions that was asked during the Q&A at the event was someone asked about, advertising being a part of this and whether they could build on top of the brain machine platform, which, like, friends, that is a solid 30 or 40 years away, I suspect, in part because I don't think that this is going to go into healthy people at any time soon. Like, the real risk here to me is infections from drilling a hole in your skull.
And is that the potential advantage of using a laser to do the drilling? Is that less likely to allow for infection?
Well, you'd have to ask Conrad, but my feeling is probably no. The reason why you have skin, not to put too fine a point on it, is to keep the outside out. And so anytime you open up a channel between the inside of your body and the outside of your body, you are necessarily exposing yourself to an infection risk.
All right. Well, I'm glad to know why we have that after 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. The Verge's Elizabeth Lopato with us and University of Pennsylvania professor Conrad Cording as well. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Professor Cording, this private company, it's working with University of California. Elizabeth also reporting that neuroscientists at Stanford University are going to be involved in some of the experiments that coming from the New York Times. What are the advantages of having private companies working with academic institutions on this?
So I think academic institutions like University of Pennsylvania, they're very good at producing ideas. They're very good at testing if the ideas can be right. They are not so good at integrating things. So what is so cool about this is that they put these different things together. For example, we just talked about infection. So one infection risk is, of course, when you open the skull to put it in. But in the past technologies, what we needed is a wire that came through the skull. Now, if you have a wire that comes through your skull, there's always a channel where bacteria can potentially get through. The cool thing is what Neuralink is working towards is it's all wireless. So it's basically you have a radio that transmits it into your skull. And therefore, like, once it has healed, there's no longer an infection risk. And scientists aren't very good at putting all these different things together because there's just no incentive for us and it's extremely expensive. And in that sense, I think industry is really complementary to our strength there.
Elizabeth, you asked a question at this event about FDA oversight or approval for the process. Where are regulators regarding this?
That's a great question. One of the things I've learned over the years is that you can never actually predict what the FDA is going to do, no matter how expert you believe yourself to be. So the answer is, who knows. But they did put out some guidance in February that seems to apply to Neuralink about doing these kinds of experiments. And again, these experiments using different technology have been done in humans. So I would not be surprised if we do see human trials. I just don't think we're probably going to see them on Neuralink's suggested timeline.
Now, Neuralink they were using this event to recruit people. What's your sense of how appealing it appears to people with expertise? Are they buying what Musk is selling here?
Yeah, I think so. So a lot of the folks I spoke to at the event were PhD students or postdocs, and they were really excited. But also I've been calling folks like Conrad, who, you know, is an expert in the field. And a lot of the experts I've been speaking to are also really excited and view the sort of near-term goals as being incredibly achievable.
I want to thank you for being with us, Elizabeth Lopato with The Verge. Thanks so much for talking about the event you attended and reported on Tuesday night at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. Neuralink, yet another Elon Musk initiative where he talked about their plans to actually by 2020 to implant with a human subject and to build this interface between computers and human brain. I'm Conrad Cording, University of Pennsylvania Professor of Bioengineering and Neuroscience. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we're going to talk with you about falling down the internet, Wikipedia research rabbit hole, losing track of time. How do you manage that? If you have a voracious appetite for information, to learn, how do you manage that in an information age where it's all right there, immediately available on your phone? 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back in 1 minute.
I'm impressed with his influential friends. He's got very big connections, and I follow his directions. Bernie knows his way around, and so I always do what Bernie...
I blame Dave Frischberg, the man you're listening to right now, because he started it all the night before last. I actually got a very serious email from Ruth Price of the Jazz Bakery about health challenges that Dave Frischberg is facing. Now, not only was My Attorney Bernie one of his very popular songs, but he wrote the lyrics for a number of the Schoolhouse Rock tunes, the music too, like I'm Just a Bill. Very creative, very inventive songwriter and musician. So as someone who's a fan of Dave Frischberg, I started looking up more about him. Who did he play with early in his career? Where was he living now? Well, all kind of stuff that I tend to obsess on and find interesting. It's actually very helpful, of course, for preparing for segments on Air Talk because I can do a deep dive into a topic and try and learn as much as I can about it. But it's not always to prepare for the show. This is an example. It was a personal interest in Dave Frischberg and in music generally. And as I'm looking up about Dave Frischberg, I come across the electric guitarist Alvino Rey. And I thought, oh, yeah, Alvino Rey, I haven't heard that name in so long. He used to be on those old King Sisters specials that were on Channel 11. They were syndicated in Los Angeles. Remember the King Sisters?
When I've got my arms around you, going for a walk.
Of course you don't, unless you're over 50 years old. But maybe you heard the name, their popular series and all their offspring, the King Cousins, the King's Uncle Aunts. They had all these musical groups from the King family. Alvino Rey was married to Louise King, one of the King sisters, and he appeared on all their specials. By the way, I found out Alvino Rey wasn't even Latino. I thought he was Latino. No, his real name was Alvin McBurney. He was born in the Midwest, and Latin music was big. He thought if he changed his name to Alvino Rey, he'd get more work as a musician. So then as I fall down the research rabbit hole further, and I click on yet another link, I find out that Wynn and Well Butler of the group Arcade Fire... are the grandkids of Alvino Rey, nay Alvin McBurney, and King's sister Louise King. What a small world. just yet another example of following down the Wikipedia and internet rabbit hole. So that's just an example, a typical Larry Knight. What's your example of falling deep down the internet rabbit hole? If you are a somewhat obsessive person like me and just can't get enough of all these different links, maybe it's music, maybe it's science, maybe it's cars, it could be law. What my son has, the law thing. He'll start looking up a case. He's so fascinated by law. Then he's onto something else. He shares my wiring clearly, but law is one of the areas where he is intense and, in fact, goes on Wikipedia and edits regularly just for fun. So clearly this is it's a neurological condition in the family. But I want to hear from you. What's your experience of it? 866-893-KPECC. And how do you manage it? Because obviously when you're in the midst of this, you're not exactly the most social person. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, KPECC.org. Ernesto in Westwood, good to have you with us. So is this you?
This is definitely me, Larry. So I'm actually an MD, PhD student, so I do research, you know, as my profession and all that jazz. But I love being on YouTube and just falling down a rabbit hole. And it always gives me a really cool perspective on different areas of science, of medicine. And actually right now I was just thinking about it. I think one of the last times I went down the rabbit hole, I went to like quantum mechanics and trying to see the math of it, dimensions might look like. Yeah. And so I love it.
That's great. So Ernesto, do you have to manage this at all? I mean, does it ever intrude into other important areas? Particularly you're a student, so you have to be, you know, studying stuff you're going to be tested on.
Yeah, definitely. So I try my best to stay off of it during the day. And I usually, like, when I get home, I'll try to get on it. But, you know, sometimes I might have an experiment and there's like a 10-minute wait. And so I'll just jump on my YouTube. And YouTube is so great with their suggested, like, videos that, you know, I'll see a video that I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then I'll start watching and forget that, you know, I have an experiment going.
Ernesto, thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, KPECC.org. If you're at all like me in this regard and you share my quirk, I would be interested in hearing how you manage it. And also, what's kind of the oddest journey that you've made clicking on one link to another and going deep into a subject area or maybe seemingly unrelated areas, but you found them connected up simply because of links on Wikipedia or generally online. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Michael in Irvine says, alarms and calendar events, how I have to manage the rabbit hole. I have ADHD and I'm autistic, so I'm very mindful of using external alarms to stay on track. That's Michael in Irvine. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Diane in La Crescenta, is this you?
Did you say Diane in La Crescenta?
Diane, excuse me, yes.
That's okay. No, this started long before, I'm a little older than you, and this started long before the internet, when I would go to the library. I would be researching a paper or something for a report, and the same thing with the reference books and the encyclopedias is I would just flip from one thing to another. It'd look interesting, so I'd go there, and then the library would close on me.
So you, same thing, you just lost track of time, next thing you know, they're locking up.
And it's not in any one particular subject. It's like everything is interesting.
Yeah.
And today, the same thing happened to me, but it's one of the reasons I don't have a smartphone and I'm not on any social media.
So that's your form of self-control. Diane, I appreciate it very much. And you bring up the issue of everything is interesting. That's my problem. Doing this program is a good fit for me because I'm not expert in anything, but I'm interested in virtually anything. There's hardly anything someone can bring up that doesn't at some level interest me and I want to learn more about it. And when I was a kid, I was going to Hollywood High School, and after school, if I didn't have something else, if I wasn't getting together with friends or something, I'd often go to the Hollywood Branch Library. And I would do just what you did. I'd get into the card files. I'd be looking at different books and how one thing relates to another. Again, again, it was great for the hours of time I have to spend prepping to do the daily show. But it was odd for a high school kid to be spending that much time. Just you describe yourself doing, just doing research in the library and stuff you don't have to research. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Juan in Little Armenia in Hollywood. What's your example of this?
Hey, it's Royal Lineages. So I'll log on and there's a website on YouTube or a page on YouTube called Useful Charts. And it just goes down every house and every continent, and yeah, basically it's like every royal family and every person that's been head of the family, you know, going back to whenever the house was started.
Do you know how you developed this interest?
I have no idea.
And do you remember this? So could you reconstruct from memory some of the lineages in these royal families?
Yeah, I mean, they're all super complicated, but, you know, you'll start with, you know, somewhere, say, for example, like the Prophet Muhammad, and then you go down through the caliphs, and then someone in the caliphs married, you know, a Turk, like an Ottoman Turk, and then therefore, you know, in 17-something, you know, the Ottomans had their first caliph, and Sultan. Yeah, so it's fascinating.
And it is all interesting. I completely understand the appeal of it. Juan, thank you. Good to have you with us. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Shannon in Mar Vista. So what hole do you typically fall down when you're online?
Oh, it's Google Earth. Once I'm on Google Earth, hours go by. I cannot stop looking up every place. Google Earth is amazing.
It is. It is. So what's the longest you've gotten caught up with Google Earth and not even realized the time had passed?
Oh, I'm going to say 2 hours, and it felt like 20 minutes. and there goes that 2 hours I'll never get back. But I'm very familiar with all the mountain ranges across the planet.
I love it. Shannon, I appreciate it. Google Earth, falling down that hole, looking up places all over. Now, another geographically related one that I've gotten caught up with, my cousin told me about an app, and I can't believe I didn't know about it, called Radio Garden. So it's the globe, and you go to any place around the world, and it shows you what the radio stations are on, and then you can click on the radio station, and its feed comes up. It's live stream of the station, and you can decide, I want to listen to an Oslo station. You just go on the map to Norway, to Oslo. It shows you the stations, and you press on it. Well, for someone like me, that's just, you know, addictive. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, talking about my odd online behavior with hours lost, looking at obscure things, Wikipedia, it can be YouTube videos. So my question for you is, what's one that, you know, maybe would surprise even your friends if they knew that it was something that you ended up very deep into online? How do you manage that so it doesn't take over your life? 866-893-KPECC. Got plenty of good calls coming in. We'll talk with you in just a moment. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. As you just heard John Raby describe all the special programming we have around Apollo 11 and its 50th anniversary of the landing on the moon, first moonwalk. Tomorrow, a very special Air Talk. We do it live at our Crawford Family Forum here at KPCC. It's a free event, but we have limited capacity. Please reserve your space. I hope to see you tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock here at KPCC. Visit kpecc.org. www.cbn.org/in-person. If you can't be here in person, we will be video streaming it live at kpcc.org. We invite you to watch it even if you can't be in the room for the live broadcast. But if you can be here, so much the better. Again, kpcc.org/in-person. Belinda writes on the AirTalk page, yesterday I heard the promo for Fresh Air that Terry was interviewing Randy Rainbow. So I went to YouTube to see what new videos he had out. Next thing I knew, I'd not only missed the rest of Air Talk, but I missed the very Fresh Air episode I was researching. I love it, Belinda. That's very funny. I've had similar moments to that. Beth says, as a teacher, it's great to take advantage of students going down rabbit holes to investigate something. We can open up new windows for later exploration if kids get continually diverted. Beth, that's great to know. Yeah, take advantage of kids' natural curiosity. Jeffrey in Beverly Hills says, Larry's program is stimulus for many of my rabbit hole adventures. I'll hear a word I don't know. I'll check my dictionary. Then I go down the rabbit hole from there. Yeah, Jeffrey, dictionaries. Oh my gosh. Yeah, you can just you just be gone. James in Pasadena says, I'm a professor at Pasadena City College. I get caught up on YouTube political videos. I love politics. One thing leads to another. I recently was watching old Mitt Romney speeches. I assume that's Mitt Romney, not his dad. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Samantha and Reseda says, for me, food videos. Now I know how to make macaroons. 866-893-KPECC. So in case you just tuned in, what are you talking about, Larry? I started with anecdote night before last about getting an email from Ruth Price of the Jazz Bakery about a GoFundMe for a terrific jazz musician, songwriter, lyricist Abe Frischberg, raising money for some health challenges he had. Started researching him, ended up going down a musical rabbit hole on Wikipedia, ending up with the rock group Arcade Fire. And so asking you, do you have similar kinds of things where you end up at, you start looking at something and time goes by, you lose track of it. What's some of the wildest connections you've made? How do you deal with the amount of time that you invest in doing this? 866-893-KPECC. Joshua in Santa Ana, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. So what's your example of this?
So I actually have some friends who we've turned it into a game called Wikipedia Races, where we challenge each other to get from one topic to a seemingly unrelated topic in as few clicks as possible. So like, how quickly can you get from gummy bears to the Mariana Trench by clicking on links in Wikipedia?
I love it. And so who typically wins that? What are the skills that enable you to get there fastest?
Just recognizing, like, thinking if I need to get to the Mariana Trench, what's going to be links from the gummy bear page that will get me there. You don't necessarily always want to click on the very first link that you see. You might want to take your time scrolling through just to see if there's anything that's relevant that will get you there.
Yeah, that sounds fun. And how frequently do you do this with your friends?
Oh, just if we've been, like, really stressed and we need something to relieve stress, or if like we're waiting in line at Disneyland or something, like what can we do to pass the time while we're waiting in line?
Joshua, it's great. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Joshua in Santa Ana. A story scene writes on the page, funny about this discussion, I recently deleted Facebook and Twitter from my phone for this very reason. I'm an artist. I've worked at home for over 25 years. And 2 hours after researching something on Amazon and their suggestions, I ended up still there, not getting, it sounds like she didn't get by what she was searching, but learned about different artistic techniques, tools, possibilities, and then ended up with 15 more items in her shopping cart. That happens to a lot of people. 866-893-KPECC. Joe in Long Beach says he fell down the same rabbit hole I did because he got the same email that went out to the list of the Jazz Bakery from Ruth Price and ended up going down the same sorts of links I did. Joe, that's funny. Thanks so much. Cynthia in San Gabriel, what's the rabbit hole you fall down?
My rabbit hole, Larry, is called pedigree Pedigree Query, and it researches bloodlines of racehorses. I'm an avid racehorse fan, so when I see my favorites running, I often like to see, well, what was their mother? What was their father? And on and on and on. It goes back many generations, and I really get caught up in, you know, finding out the background of a horse, its genetic background, and it teaches you a lot about how the horse might run or its characteristics, too, when you see what the parents have done and grandparents, et cetera.
I completely get your interest. That's fascinating. Now, do you actually use this information in the deep research to bet at the track?
Well, I really don't bet. I just love to watch them run. I work at Santa Anita, and they frown on us betting. So I've just learned to love the horse for itself and where it came from, you know, a conglomeration of many, many different horses that made it the beautiful thing that it is today.
Cynthia, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Cynthia in San Gabriel, 866-893-KPCC. Lori, in West Los Angeles, what's your rabbit hole?
Well, my very first rabbit hole, because I've got two. My very first one was the very first time I ever went online when we got America Online on our computer back about 2001.
Dial-up technology.
You know it. I'm sitting in West L.A., all of a sudden, I'm looking at things at Harvard University, and the next thing I know, I'm visiting the Louvre in Paris, and I don't have a passport.
Yeah, yeah, and it's
I was literally freaking out in my living room. I was so excited.
So today, what do you end up obsessing on if you do?
When watching a TV show or a movie, and I'm curious about the actors, I will go to IMDb. And I will check everybody's filmography. They look familiar. What have I seen them in before? Oh, they were in this thing. I should watch that. And the best thing that ever came out of that was checking the Downton Abbey folks' filmographies. Michelle Dockery led me to a movie she was in called Hogfather, which introduced me and my daughter to the world of the author Terry Pratchett.
Lori, this is great. I love it. That sort of serendipity that comes from research. This is actually a little bit of a sore spot you raised in my household. It's very hard for me to watch something, a TV series, episode, or film at home and not have questions come up. What's that location? Who's that actor? And then I'm on IMDb as the movie's going, and it can be a little distracting, let's say, to the other people that are in the room trying to watch it at the same time. All right, I appreciate it, Lori. And Dee Dee in Long Beach, what's the rabbit hole you fall down?
Hi, well, it's become, I used to love big glossy magazines, travel, cooking, fashion, so many things. Now, I've canceled all my subscriptions because I can watch it all on Instagram, see gorgeous, gorgeous photos of, you know, if I'm looking up Italy, then all of a sudden I find so many tiny villages, and you just go on and on, and then my iPad tells me how much time I've spent, which I didn't ask to find that out.
So is that gives you chagrin when you see what?
A little chagrin.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a bit guilty, but I do view for a few more minutes. But boy, it's a beautiful way to see the world without having stacks of magazines, you know, in your living room.
Very good point. Dee Dee in Newport Beach, I appreciate it. Also, maybe your neighbor in Newport Beach, Dee Dee, Layla, says live police videos on YouTube. You know, there's that A&E network show, Live PD, which is kind of a guilty pleasure. I mean, I have to be careful not to start watching that show. It takes you around police departments all around the country, and it can be the most mundane kind of stuff, but the idea it's live. It's, you know, that's the come on. So for Layla, she falls down that rabbit hole with YouTube videos. And John in South Pasadena says there used to be a website called Stumble Upon. It was like an automatic rabbit hole, collection of the most interesting and completely random things on the internet. John says he used to spend hours on it. I don't know if it's still there. It sounds like he's not sure either, but That's something that obviously tries to take advantage of this. Julie says, I love various language sites. I could spend hours on the Lyrics Translate site adding and correcting song lyrics. Easiest way to lose an entire afternoon. RTB says, I've skipped dinner when too involved, only to realize too late to either go out or I'm too tired to cook. Computer dieting, RTB asks. You can share your comments about falling down, your own obsessions online, links that might or might not be connected, and where you go from there on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Wonderful calls. Great to have you with us on the program. Again, I hope you'll join me live tomorrow, our 10 o'clock hour of AirTalk, a special hour devoted to the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 and the landing on the moon, the first moonwalk. Got a great panel of guests. RSVP, it's free, but let us know you're coming, please. kpecc.org/in-person. And if you can't be here, watch the live video stream of it, kpecc.org. I'll be back in a minute. You might have heard the tragic story out of Kyoto, Japan this morning. A man screaming, "You die," burst into an animation studio, doused it with a flammable liquid, and set it on fire. 33 people were killed. 36 others were injured, some of those critically. So we may not have a final tally of fatalities. Is that horrible an event? It's brought an outpouring of grief, not just from Japanese citizens, but from anime fans. That's what Kyoto Animation was known for. They do work on feature films and TV production. And with us, Charles Solomon, KPCC Film Week critic, who's come in to talk with us about this terrible event and what this studio is known for. Charles, you just did an LA Times review of one of their films?
Yeah, the Sound Euphonium feature. This was a studio that had been founded back in the 80s by veterans of Osamu Tezuka's Mushi Productions. It was Hideaki Hatta and his wife Yoko. And this was one of the few studios that, instead of just using freelancers and part-timers and short-term workers, had a regular staff that was actually paid, you know, a good wage, which is quite rare in Japanese animation. They're facing a shortage. And this was a very popular studio. It was known as Kyoani, as you know, an elision. Probably their most popular property were the films about Haruhi Suzumiya, the high school girl with these mysterious powers. There was both a TV show and a feature, very well loved. But it was also a studio where there were two of probably the most prominent women directors in Japan, in an era where there are still very, very few women directing then. Hiroko Utsumi did a series called Free about high school swimmers, and very slyly turned all the conventions of what's termed a fan service show on its head. This is usually films about where pretty girls, you get shots of their panties and their cleavage, and they have big meetings in hot springs and the shower room that are aimed at hormonal teenage boys. And this is a series about
high school. As opposed to other teenagers, I was going to say.
That's pretty much all of them, isn't it?
Yeah.
But in this case, it's high school swimmers who are all there in their Speedos, and she plays the same kind of scenes but in a mirror image. The other director was Naoko Yamada, who did a film called A Silent Voice that was a very strong, unflinching look at bullying in schools. It's about a deaf girl who's bullied by one of the boys in her class, and her mother takes her away. And for years, the boy and the other classmates live with their guilt until he learns sign language. He tries to apologize, and he learns, you know, the meaning of forgiveness and to seek it and to forgive himself. And it's a very, very touching film, very serious. So two major talents there. And in contrast to something that's serious, I think my favorite of their films is a nutty series called Full Metal Panic Fumafu, which is just so take no prisoners silly. You look at it and say, you know, We're the country that made the Warner Brothers cartoons. Why can't we be this silly anymore?
Charles, this is such a horrible event. It's almost hard to understand the degree of loss here. How does this affect the general animation community, which I know not everybody knows each other, but I still think, I mean, there's a real affinity people have who work in this business.
Yeah, no, it's a relatively close-knit community, and the festivals and the organization ASIFA, sort of works at bringing everybody together, and it's still a fairly small group despite the amount of production. And this morning I'm on the board of ASIFA Hollywood, and we were talking and from our Animation Aid Foundation sent some money to the Kickstarter site for them that's raising money for the people victimized. And that's already – they've raised over $400,000 the last I saw in
wow.
a couple of hours because – other artists and fans of their work, you know, rally around them.
We don't know the work that the people's lives who lost or were severely injured were doing at this anime studio. So we don't know in terms of animators, creative people, so to speak. But I would think this kind of thing would – I mean, you're talking about a loss – potentially of artists as well, and this could have an effect on the industry.
Oh, very, very much so, particularly at a time when Japan is facing a shortage of animators. But we forget how Japan is such a not violent country. This, if the figures stand, is still killed far more people than the sarin gas attacks in 1995 by the Ulm cult. That was such a traumatic moment. This may be the most violent attack to occur in Japan since World War II. You know, they don't have mass shootings the way we do. This is very, very rare, and I think it'll have an enormous psychological impact, not only on the artists working in animation there, but on the Japanese public in general. You know, Kyoto is the ancient capital of Japan. It's the center of traditional Japanese culture. And so for something that horrible to happen, I don't know that there's a comparable city in the U.S. that has the kind of reverence that, Kyoto kind of embodies.
Just terrible news. In case you just joined us and maybe you hadn't heard this morning, 33 people killed in what authorities say was an arson attack on Kyoto Animation in the Japanese city of Kyoto. 36 others were injured, some of them critically. A fire that was believed to have been intentionally set by an individual at the entrance to the building apparently kept people inside from being able to escape. And just a terrible, terrible event. Charles, thank you for coming in and talking with us about this animation studio. Did you ever visit it when you went
no,
to Japan?
No, I've never been to Kyoto. I don't know any of the artists there personally, but I know their work.
All right, thank you. Charles Solomon, KPCC Film Week critic. He'll be with us tomorrow on Film Week at 11 here on 89.3 KPCC. We always appreciate your being with us. Have a good afternoon. Fresh Air is next.